Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and our special guest today is Randy Grigg. Randy Grigg is an entrepreneur, a business owner, a property manager, a buy and hold real estate investor, and author of The Carrot Approach to Single Family House Management, and a friend. Randy, welcome to our show.
How you doing, Bruce?
I'm good, and I've been looking forward to this. I reread your Carrot Approach because I had a very specific thing personally in mind, and I really enjoyed it. So we'll get to that. Before real estate, you had an entirely different career. So let's talk about that first, and then how somehow you managed to end up investing in real estate. So what did you do first to support yourself?
Well, after graduating from UC Riverside, I got a master's degree. I went into the agricultural business, and my wife and I left Southern California, and we went to Bakersfield. And Bakersfield, I actually worked for a chemical company, I think this was in 1976, selling chemical pesticides and fertilizers to farmers. And then also checking their fields for insect pests and fertility situations on their plants, whatever crops they were growing. Mm-hmm. And then after about a year and a month, I didn't like the corporate thing, so I decided to go out on my own. And I did basically the same thing, but instead of selling the chemicals, I sold the consulting service. I told them what to use on the chemical, on the crops, and then they would typically bid out the chemicals to the different chemical companies, and I did that for 30 years, pretty much.
And being self-employed took up more or less time than having the job?
Actually, more time, because the business took off pretty good, so I had a lot of acres to cover. I think I had 30,000 acres that I had to watch. And so I was moving, you know, 6-7 days a week. So it took a lot of time.
How did you squeeze real estate in, and when did you first attempt to do that?
Well, as I was working in agriculture, I went to various real estate seminars in the late 70s, early 80s, and I learned about buying property, mainly to hold, and I got involved in learning the stuff first, and then I started buying one here, one there, and I ended up very low volume, but I tried to buy one to maybe as many as three per year, and I did that for like 25 years.
Yeah, that's a very methodical approach. When you get together with somebody, let's say, and you say, well, here's the plan, it only takes 25 years, and What's their reaction to that?
Their reaction is, you know, I think I like the flipping side of the business better than the holding side, if that's what it's going to take. Now, it took me a long time because I just didn't have much time. So if I was devoting more time, I probably could have bought more property faster and got to my financial independence goal a lot quicker.
Did you set out with that in mind? Is that kind of what the plan was from the very beginning when you bought your first few houses, that you had an end goal and there'll be someday that I don't need to work?
My goal at the time, I was making $19,000 a year, not a month now, Bruce, just $19,000 a year.
Okay.
And so my goal was to have enough income, maybe $2,000 a month in income, to support my lifestyle through net rents that I received from the tenants.
You know, one of the things that's important, I think, that we shouldn't miss is that the early mentors that you listened to, that was the model that they did. That was the model that you got exposed to. I didn't have that. That was my fault. I didn't go into the education side of it as much as I just stepped into it. And the model I stepped into it was a flip model. Mm-hmm. And that's what I got used to. And so I practiced that fairly well for a long period of time before I got the idea that I should actually have something that comes in without my daily effort. Mm-hmm. And it really didn't kick in until, you know, probably I would say close to 15 or 18 years into the gig of buying and selling houses before I started thinking I wanted to solve the monthly nut.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
It really does matter who you get taught by.
It does. It really does. And all my guru guys were pretty much exclusively holders. They didn't flip too much. You know, it was pretty much, let's hold them forever.
Yeah, right? You know, it seems more exotic to get into the, you know, the flipping stuff and you get the chunk of dough. But the real winners at the end of the day seem to be that methodical bunch that end up owning these pile of houses without any debt.
Yeah, those are the guys that sometimes have pretty good cash flow for sure.
Yeah, and you know, that's you also can get caught up in the net worth sheet. You know, you sit there and I remember it's interesting. This was an extreme example, but this is right at the peak, and there was a gentleman that had been teaching everybody across the country to buy and hold houses, but he really didn't do it for the same cash flow reasons. It was sort of an interesting combination, but this guy that came in, he heard me speak, and I was talking about the market changing and maybe ending and going down, and he said, I've just never heard anybody express that. And he showed me his properties. He had about 65 properties he owned, and his negative monthly was like 20 grand.
Oh, man. Wow.
And it was 2006, and I said, why do you own these things? He said, because they went up. So his net worth was about $3 million, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
But he had, you know, if you think about how much real estate he had, about $10 million real estate plus.
Yeah.
And I said, to be honest with you, I think you've got like 90 days to get out of this stuff and end up walking away being a multimillionaire. And if you don't, you're going to end up the other way.
Yeah.
And, you know, he played the net worth card, and he had a sheet, and he showed it to everybody. It was his business card. It was an 8.5 by 11 business card showing everybody. That was bragging rights. He had a $4 million net worth and a 20-plus negative monthly.
Whoa.
That's pretty heavy.
That's heavy.
Yeah.
Wow. He must have had a good side job support those houses.
His job was getting other people involved and selling them houses to get into the same circumstance he was.
Ooh.
Yeah, and I mean,
Ponzi-like.
Yeah, well, it turned out to be obviously not a happy ending, but I don't think it was his intent. When somebody goes down with his own plan, at least you got to give him credits, like, okay.
Yeah, you try.
Yeah, you bought into the whole thing yourself, but the early mentors that you had, one of the things I remember reading is that you not only liked them for what they did, but you also liked them for who they were.
Oh yeah.
So let's talk about some of those guys that did that and then did it right. You know, taught people to do it the right way.
Well, you know, it's funny, and I don't know what Florida has over other states, but all three of these guys are from Florida. One's Jack Miller, and you know these guys as well as I do, and John Schaub and Pete Fortunato.
Yeah.
And they're all Florida guys, and yet they were all good guys. They still are. Jack has passed away, but a lot of integrity, a lot of knowledge, and very good teachers. All three of them were very good teachers of the information that they had and the experiences they went through in their quest.
One of the things that you also said is that when you purchased a property, you know, you created a successful investment with or without price increases and with or without rental increases.
Yes, that was sort of after I learned the hard knocks. See, I had not a $20,000 a month negative cash flow, but I had a $2,000 a month negative cash flow when I finally realized that, hey, properties, you don't get tax benefits, or you're not supposed to get tax benefits from negative cash flow. That's not good strategy, you know. So every time I invested, once I learned the ropes, I tried to at least net break even on the cash flow. And I tried to make at least $100 a month in net rental income. This is going back a way.
Yeah.
And that was my goal. And I assumed that rents would not go up, and I assumed that properties wouldn't appreciate. And in Bakersfield, they don't do a lot of that.
they fulfilled that on occasion.
Yeah, they fulfilled my... So it worked pretty good, and that's the only way I really felt comfortable doing it.
But over time, obviously, what started to happen was that the debt you had against it started to turn into zero.
Exactly. And you know, most of my deals were either taking over existing loans, and then if there was still equity I had to deal with, then I would structure, let's say, a second note that I would, and that's the one that I really massaged because I was forced to stay with the first note. I couldn't change. I couldn't massage that. So that's how I did it. I would, you know, have lower payments, lower interest, no interest. And, you know, usually with a down payment, a lot of people say, oh, just buy them with no down. And it's more difficult when people have equity and they're feeling fairly good about their financial situation. So you have to give them a down payment usually, mm-hmm. which that's another reason that I only bought 1 to 3 because I had to come out of pocket $5,000 or $10,000 for each house that I bought.
And two, the loan base, let's say the established loan base in place, if you were talking about getting involved in the late 70s and early 80s, yeah. even all the way to, you know, late 80s, that was not 5%. That was not there.
It wasn't. You know, it's like 9, 8 maybe, but I'm going to say somewhere between 8 and 9. It seemed to be the interest rate that I was dealing with back
right.
then.
So, you know, that's the we definitely have a group of people that think nothing of this interest rate that's now gone all the way up to 4. You know, I see the article. Interest rates soar to 4%. You just go, wow, gotta be kidding me.
Give me those loans, please.
Do you think it was an advantage to live in a community that had a price point like a Bakersfield? Do you mm-hmm. think that was an advantage to what you accomplished?
I don't think so. I think with the information that I had, I think I could be in pretty much any area and figure out a way to make it happen. I would probably use investors to pay, let's say, if there was negative cash flow, maybe providing the funds to buy the property, you know, down payments and whatnot. But I then take an interest in the deal, like a 50% interest, and maybe do the management for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I could be put anywhere and still survive.
I mean, that's kind of why I asked the question. I thought I'd get that answer. Jack Fullerton got taught by the same guys and did it in Orange County, for goodness sakes.
Exactly.
I think that's what's great about real estate is that it doesn't really matter where you live. If you have enough knowledge, you can sit down with somebody and say, you know what, if you've got a problem you'd like to solve, we can sit down and bombard it with solutions and come out with something that works for them and for you. And that's obviously been your strategy. You try to make it a transaction where not only did you get what you wanted, but you solved somebody else's issue. And now what's interesting is you've now taken that to the other side. When you say, okay, it's usually you're just saying, okay, let's have a rental. What was your experience when you just presented the property as a typical rental in the area? What was the competition like, and how long did it take to, you know, to fill that rental property?
Well, it sort of depended on the market, sort of like your strategy. You know, the market's going up now, the market's probably going to peak and go down now. So when the rental market's hot, you can do just about anything and get them rented. You know, it's sort of like when you flip, market's hot, you can do anything and it sells with a bidding war. Now, the market in Bakersfield is typically sort of ho-hum the whole time, so I didn't really have that benefit completely. There were times when it was pretty good, times where it wasn't good at all. But it's sort of like right in the middle most of the time. So being, you know, employed or self-employed, the ag business, I had to figure out a way that I could hold these older houses, 30 to 60-year-old houses, that were cosmetically distressed a little bit, and how I could get by with getting them occupied without fixing them big time, you know, going in and doing all the things that some of the landlords do. So I had to compete with that. I had to compete with a good house right next door that was for rent and was fixed up nicely, looked good. And so what I ended up doing through trial and error was to say, I'll make it sort of look good outside. I'll mow the lawn and maybe paint the trim and maybe do a little bit inside, but I'm not going to put any carpet in typically unless it's totally, totally bad. I might spot paint the walls. I'm probably going to use the existing tile or vinyl that's in the house. And I'm going to try a different strategy, and that is to give the tenant the chance to be a homeowner. And so through trials and tribulations, figuring out how to do that, I finally have evolved to a pretty good thing, I think. It works well for me, at least.
When you, the first person that kind of gave you an idea to give some type of hope of ownership was Robert Bruss.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the suggestion he made, and that was like your first transition away from just a standard, you know, you can rent my property.
Well, Bob had a newsletter out, and I subscribed to it and read it from cover to cover. It was a nice newsletter.
Oh, yeah. He was a great guy, too. I don't know if you knew him, but he was a really nice guy.
Real nice guy. And he gave me the idea, the initial idea, and he, of course, he talked in lease options.
Exactly.
And then he would do something totally different than what I do now, but basically, he was trying to sell the properties through the lease option versus trying to hold the property through a rent-to-own type scenario. So he would typically get a bunch of money up front as option consideration, as much as he could, and he'd set the term at 1 year, and then he would give a whopping credit towards the purchase price, like 25% to 50%. Of the rent payment would go towards the purchase price. And Bob used just one form. He used a lease combined with an option, all in one. And anyway, through time, I didn't want to use that strategy. I felt uncomfortable with it, so I don't do that. But that was his program. It was mainly to sell, and John Schaub always pretty much is attempting to sell through the lease option as well. So they use sort of similar strategies,
okay.
Different documentation.
Okay. Now, there's a hybrid that, and this is, you know, a little bit off subject, but usually when somebody in our world, the investor world, gives a lease option, the goal is to get this pile of money up front, and when the person doesn't perform, they think it's going to be easy to say, okay, well, you didn't live up to your end of the agreement, I'm going to evict you, and I'm going to do it again. In California, that sometimes is a flawed process.
It really is, and I've been to court enough times, not many, but enough times to know I really don't want the tenant to feel like they have an equitable interest in the property that I own. So one way I do that is I don't take a lot of option consideration up front, you know, maybe 1% up front. I like a lot of money up front, so it usually is allocated towards more security deposit. And I'm not saying that I wouldn't if I really wanted to sell the property. I would feel comfortable if they qualified and looked like their credit was really good and they had money and they just, it was a timing issue, then I would probably do something with more money up front.
Mm-hmm.
But my tenants typically don't have the best credit, don't have a lot of money, probably will never be homeowners, even though if I encourage them to do that, and I don't try to put a stop. If they really want to buy the house, I'll do everything I can to get them qualified through mortgage brokers that I know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit different strategy. The rent's about the same as what the market rent is. A lot of people that do lease options, they jack up the rent maybe oh, let's just use a number, maybe $300 or $400 more than market rent, and they give that as a credit.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't do that.
What changes have you noticed occur when someone goes from just being a tenant to someone that thinks someday they can own the house?
We always have, I shouldn't say always, that's a bad word, but when we open it up to the general public, a house, let's say, we have the group that you could tell are just interested in renting the house, and they don't really have any motivation to ever be a homeowner. And then we have probably 70%, let's say, of the applicants that really want to be a homeowner. And we use some forms that sort of see that we attempt to find out if they truly are homeowner material, because we want that mindset, at least in the house, versus a renter's mindset. And so,
well, how does that translate in practical terms? So the person that you typically get in there that thinks that their goal is to own that home, how do they handle things differently? How do they pay you on time? How do they do little repairs? How often mm-hmm. do you get called versus just having a renter?
A renter is going to typically call you for everything. We have in our rental agreement that we use, we have them choose what option they want. And one option is they take care of the first $150 of any and all repairs after the first 60 days. 60 days, we take care of everything because we don't want to, we don't want them to have problems when they move in. And then they have the option of we'll take care of everything for another $75 a month. And they have that option, and they can change anytime they want, because I know California, and they want the landlord to take care of everything. So I let them choose the option, and they can choose back the other option if they want. So if they pick the initial, I want to pay less rent, they'll check that. They'll initial that box.
Mm-hmm.
But I give them, like, any time, just give me 30-day notice and we'll switch it back the other way if you want me to do everything, if you want to pay more rent. Now, everyone but one tenant in 25 years always picks the lower rent. Now, do they do all the repairs? No,
mm-hmm.
they don't. I would be in a seminar, given a seminar, if I said that, because I would want to blow up the how great it is to have the tenants take care of all the repairs. They take care of more of the repairs, and they stay longer in the house, and they, in the back of their mind, most of them think that one day they may own the house. I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah, what percentage of the tenants that you have actually exercise, I don't know if they're, I'm going to say option, but you know what I mean, end up being saying, I'm ready to buy it?
I would say, in the book, I say 5%. If they get new financing, I'm going to reduce that to probably 1% to 2% that actually get new financing or pay cash and buy the house. If I carry the financing, see, I want at least a 10% down, and here recently it's been closer to a 20% down payment.
Mm-hmm.
I have to be careful with all the legislation that's out there now, too. So then I that usually takes them out of the game with a down payment, because tenants typically don't have money for down, and they don't have the best credit. So
but they're still, they continually, well, down to 30 seconds too. But because that the carrot is out there, that the it's still a possibility, you end up with all the benefits along the way and fully intentions to keep them, that option open for them any day they can perform.
Absolutely. It's a two-year agreement that I start with, and then I do a one-year extension after that, pretty much indefinitely.
Okay. Randy, we've run out of time for this segment. Thanks for joining us. We've been with Randy Grigg, and we will talk some more on the next segment.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.